All right, welcome to Powerhouse Politics. I am ABC News Chief White House Correspondent Jonathan Carl.
And I'm ABC News Political Director Rick Klein. I can confirm John actually tried to play this one. It's a full-on air guitar for today's episode. He is feeling it.
We are. It's the Friday before Election Day. And as we've pointed out, Election Day is about as late. It is literally as late as it
can
possibly be. I think.
Thank the founders.
If I remember correctly, it has to be. Is it the? It's the first Tuesday after the first
Monday. That's how it works.
It couldn't be November. So we're November 8th. This is as late as it can be.
It's really a wonderful thing that we've been gifted this extra whole week of campaigning because it's allowed extra whole weeks of polling and extra whole weeks of freakouts and news coverage and everything.
And we're going to gain an hour,
that's
right? Because we're falling back.
The World Series went extra innings in seventh game, and it's the same here.
Okay, so let's get a quick check in, Rick. Remind ourselves of where we stand. Friday, we have our tracking poll, which now shows a Hillary Clinton lead, although my friend Ryan Strzok, who follows polls for us, would get very mad at me for saying that because it's not a lead. It's within the margin of error, so it means we're statistically tied. They're neck and neck. But you and I like
but
to
it's,
just,
But it's
you
3 points.
It says plus three on the Hillary.
It says plus three. Yes. Her name is first, and we're still seeing
but
a competitive.
But it's close. It's close. It's a, you know.
Well, an interesting dynamic because we have seen a few more battleground state polls, and we're seeing New Hampshire just as close as it can possibly be. We're seeing new signs that that Wisconsin is competitive, Pennsylvania potentially, where the Clinton campaign is now going to close things out. And you're seeing now these efforts by the Clinton campaign, these very surgical efforts to go in and drive up turnout in individual markets and individual places, using celebrities, Jay-Z to James Taylor. They're all out there working on behalf of Clinton.
And no sign of Chachi anywhere on the other side.
Oh,
Trump has not really deployed his celebrities. And then I like to, at this point, you know, as we're going in the final stretch, always check in with our friends at 538, Nate Silver's operation. He now presents a 64.1. You got to love the precision chance of Hillary Clinton winning the presidency. That means, Rick, and you're good at math, that means 35.9% chance that Donald Trump is the next president of the United States, according to our friends at 538. That is more than a one-third chance that he wins. I think that that has a lot of people who check in at 538 a lot, a little nervous.
Well, and here's another way to look at what 35.9%. It's 1 in 3. Let's say that was
1 in 3.
Let's say that was a batting average. That would be a .359 batting average. Now you've got a guy coming up to the plate.
You got a batting title,
the
man.
Biggest,
like
the biggest at bat of the year, right? Your biggest at bat of the year. The guy's hitting .359. You like your chances?
Wow, that's pretty dramatic. So. And you know, we talked a little bit about this yesterday. There's more evidence of it today. One of the absolute striking things about this race is it looks like the map is scrambled. Today we had a poll. Again, my friend Ryan doesn't really like it very much, but there was a poll out of Michigan that showed it within 5 points.
Ryan's from Michigan, so.
Yes, we've had recent polls out of Pennsylvania that have showed the margin 4 points. And I'll tell you, Rick, just between you and me on this.
Sure, yeah.
When you talk to people in both campaigns,
yeah,
they will tell you that Michigan, they believe,
yeah,
and I would include the Clinton team on this, they believe that Michigan is even closer than that poll that Ryan doesn't like.
Yeah, and that
Michigan.
Could be, yeah, that could be a big surprise.
The Clinton team thinks they're going to win there. I mean, this is a state that hasn't gone Republican since '88, if I'm correct on this. But they think there's a chance that Trump could win in Michigan.
That's right, and still lose the presidency potentially as well.
It helps him make up some grounds. He can afford to lose some. He could afford to lose Nevada.
Right.
He could afford to lose, you know, New Hampshire, maybe not much else.
Maybe not much more than that. But another tidbit that I think is fascinating right now, we're seeing a little bit of conflicting information coming out in public polling as well as private perceptions right now in both North Carolina and Florida. Now, either one of those, Hillary wins either one of those, it's basically game, set, match, or go
home. Lights out, yeah.
There's, I think, a growing confidence on the part of the Clinton campaign for Florida and a pessimism among Republicans about their potential to hold Florida. Conversely, North Carolina trending a little bit up for Republicans. Now, I would have put it the other way around. I would have thought North Carolina is a surer bet, potentially going back to Clinton, back to the Democrats. But it may be the other way around. And the story in Florida is the Latino vote. And
it's moved recently because as recently as a week or 10 days ago, talking to Republicans, they were saying if the election is now, we're going to win in Florida. You know the way Karl Rove talks about Florida. It's like the further north you go, the further south you are. I mean, North Carolina, I mean, Florida's got a lot of solid Republican votes, of course, up in the panhandle in central Florida. But it's, I think you're right. It's the Hispanic vote. Yeah. There are many more Hispanic voters in Florida now than there were 4 years ago. And Trump is a uniquely toxic candidate for a lot of those voters.
And that similar story could play out in Colorado and in Nevada and keep New Mexico off the map. So that, I think, would be very interesting because we're seeing in the early vote, for whatever that's worth, it's the only data we got right now, we're seeing in the early vote some drop-off among African-American votes in a lot of these critical battlegrounds. You can make up for that in a state like Florida in a way that you can't in North Carolina. There aren't enough Latinos to make that gap back up. But the Clinton coalition is starting to come into view. And if she wins, one of the big stories will be Latino votes and how they gravitated to the Democratic Party against Donald Trump.
We talked on this podcast about how the early vote can be, not a great predictor about what's going to happen. You know, you can analyze it 10 different ways and come up with difference in it. But the one thing I think we can say, there are a few things we can say about the early vote that we're seeing right now. First of all, I think we're at close to 35 million nationwide who have voted. We're in a situation in Florida where early vote is off the charts. Now, there were about 5 extra days of early vote in about 75% of the state. But early vote numbers are off the charts in Florida. And I think what we can say is across the key early vote states, Florida, Nevada, North Carolina, Iowa, Colorado, there is an advantage for the most part for Democrats, but it's less of an advantage than they had 4 years ago.
That's right. And they're seeing people cut into it. Now, it's hard to judge on this because
the country's changing.
So much more of the country is voting early also. The concept of Election day is fading away very, very quickly. And I think part of this is you mentioned New Hampshire a moment ago and Pennsylvania. Those are two states that don't have early vote. And you see a lot of attention over the last few days at those states because they're potentially movable up to the very, very last moment. I don't think it's a mistake that the Clintons and the Obamas will be spending the night before the election in Philadelphia, a big urban center, big African-American vote, and of course a state where almost everyone hasn't voted yet. So that's where the final focus pretty much has to be. And look, I think there's a level of nervousness that Democrats will have, though, regardless, up until beyond the exit polls and beyond the moment that this is the race is actually projected for someone, in that they just don't know what the Trump vote looks like. And that brings us back to the upper Midwest, brings us back to Michigan, brings us back to Wisconsin as part of the discussion. If those states are in play, it opens up a whole round of new maps.
And I should say on this podcast, we are going to try to elevate things a little bit today. We're going to be joined in just a couple of minutes by an actual Rhodes Scholar. This is a big deal. We're going to be joined by somebody who has served in the United States Senate, who's somebody who is in the Basketball Hall of Fame, somebody who has run for president, somebody who is seen as one of the real kind of thoughtful elder statesmen in this country. Senator Bill Bradley will join. I think we're actually got him on hold. We're not going to keep him on hold very long. We'll get to him in just a minute.
He went to a decent undergraduate school, too.
Yeah, he went to school somewhere in New Jersey. What blows me away, and we're going to get to this with him, is that I covered Bradley in the Senate. I covered his presidential campaign. This is a guy who one of his kind of core issues was campaign finance reform, and he has now started a super PAC. we're going to ask him about that. But I got to say, just before we turn to Senator Bradley, one thing that I will say, you know, this is the point where you really can't trust anything that either campaign is telling you because, I mean, we are down to the point where, you know, it's desperation time. They're trying to get every last thing they can get, and they want to get the best spin for the final days. But watching the body language of both sides, I am detecting a little less confidence on the part of Republicans. And a little more confidence, but skittishness on the part of Democrats. Democrats think Hillary Clinton is going to win this, but they're not ready to bet the ranch on it, and they're worried. They're worried about the prospects of an upset. But on the other side, the flip side is I'm detecting a little more confidence on the part of Republicans that they may actually have a shot of holding the Senate.
Yeah, and that may be the double-barreled hit of the Obamacare rate increase and James Comey coming out with that letter that gave Republicans just enough extra juice toward the end to make the argument about needing a check and needing to carry that message forward. I think that assessment is right. I think whatever you see in Nate's numbers at 538 and the rest, that there's a little bit more of a sense that Hillary's riding the ship, and a little less of a sense that the Senate map is where they want it to be.
And by the way, since you brought it up, Nate does give Republicans a 38.8% chance of holding the Senate.
So it's a 388 batting average.
So it's a little bit better than their chances of winning the presidency, but still on the flip side. And we've never seen somebody with a 612 batting average.
No.
All right, let's take a quick break. We'll be right back with Senator Bill Bradley.
Hey, it's Rick here. We have another new podcast from ABC News to tell you about. It is Popcorn with Peter Travers. He talks to the biggest Hollywood stars, and I mean the absolute biggest. They stop by to talk about their new films and open up about their experience in the business. Again, that is Popcorn with Peter Travers. Find it wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the show.
Joining us on the line, Senator Bill Bradley. Senator Bradley, thank you for joining us on Powerhouse Politics.
Hey, pleased to be with both of you.
So I got to admit, it caught my eye here to see that you, one of the longstanding, maybe long-suffering advocates of campaign finance reform, clean politics, getting money out of politics, you, Senator Bradley, now have your own super PAC.
Yeah, that's true. I think the danger of nuclear war transcends any other issue. I think that
even campaign finance reform.
Even campaign finance reform, yeah. And I really think that if people thought about it, you know, our whole life's endangered here. I think the most important job a president has is to manage international relations so we don't get to the nuclear threshold. At the end of the day, an individual has to ask him or herself when they vote for president, who do I trust with my life? And nuclear war, that means, you know, it's not some war in a distant place of the world like Iraq or Afghanistan, but it's here and it could kill millions of people. And quite frankly, I think that's a relevant question. Who do you trust for your life? Now, if it was John McCain or Mitt Romney, I would trust them with my life. But I don't trust Donald Trump with my life because I don't think he's got the experience or the ability to defuse a crisis diplomatically before it gets to the nuclear threshold. And then I think there's a personality issue. I mean, he's erratic. He's undisciplined. He lashes out. I don't think we want that kind of person in charge of our nuclear weapons. I mean, just look at the debates. He couldn't focus for an hour and a half. He focused for 30 minutes, for 45 minutes. If you're president of the United States, you have to be focused 24/7, particularly in a nuclear age.
So, you know, it was back in 1964 that Bill Moyers produced the famous Daisy ad against Barry Goldwater. And that ad, which, of course, famously only ran once, but is perhaps the most famous attack ad in the history of American politics. But there was subtlety to it. It was the girl picking the daisy, and then at the end you see the mushroom cloud. It doesn't directly mention Goldwater. You have produced this ad, and we are in a form of radio in our podcast world, so we can't actually visualize the ad, but I want to play it anyway. You'll hear the ad and just know, of course, as you know, Senator Bradley, it has this very powerful image of a mushroom cloud. Please play the ad.
One nuclear bomb can kill a million people. That's more than all the men, women, and children living in Columbus, Ohio.
They're hearing a guy running for president of the United States talking of maybe using nuclear weapons. Nobody wants to hear that about an American president.
Why are we making him? Why do we make him? Why do we make him? Why do we make him?
So, Senator Bradley, I have to say...
And it ends, be careful who you vote for.
Be careful who you vote for. And I have to say, it makes the Daisy ad look like one of those... gauzy, positive commercials.
It also makes it look subtle.
Yeah. The first point is the Daisy ad ran once, but it was 1964, and all the networks ran it and talked about it for a week. So it went off not because it offended people, but because they didn't need it. They're saving money to do it. And so that's the first point. Second, yeah, I mean, Barry Goldwater wasn't or isn't Donald Trump. Donald Trump is a much greater threat on this issue than Barry Goldwater was. And I feel that it needs to have a very strong, direct statement so that people understand what Bill Perry has just said. For example, Bill Perry, the former defense secretary, said we're closer to nuclear war today than we were during the Cold War, and the American people proceed blissfully ignorant of that fact. And so I think this is, we need to focus on what we're giving. We're giving the President of the United States, the President of the United States has the power to destroy the world. And we can't have somebody in there who's erratic and who unpredictable. And, you know, as I said, I'd trust Mitt Romney and John McCain with my life. I would not trust Donald Trump.
So, Senator, let's say this ad does its job. And let's say that next Tuesday Hillary Clinton wins. You know she's going to win narrowly in all likelihood, that there will be some quantity, 50 million plus Americans who will have voted for Donald Trump. What kind of posture can a President Clinton and a new Congress take toward the millions of Americans who, whatever the warnings from you and others, actually invested something in Donald Trump? Is there a responsibility to reach out to them? How do you approach that conversation post November 8th?
Well, I think that there's a segment of people who are voting for Trump that are voting just for change, no matter what. Well, show that you're the change agent. Second, there are people who've been harmed by economic change. I would go to those people. I would say, I heard you. We're going to work to try to make your lives better. And I have specific proposals. On the, to the racist, I wouldn't even acknowledge them. But the other change people and the economic people, they are, I think, people that she could reach out to and with sincerity and a specific program begin to diminish their negativity at this stage. I also think that Hillary, you know, I saw an article, a little bit back to what we were talking about earlier, I saw an article in, I think it was Wall Street Journal, by my former colleague Sam Nunn, who made the case that Trump was unfit to be commander-in-chief. And in the course of that, he said Hillary possesses the experience, the judgment, and the skill to be able to accept this incredible responsibility of a nuclear power. And so I would agree with those things about Hillary. In addition, there's a part of me that believes, and you might call this naive or simple, but part of me believes that deep down Hillary wants to do as much good as she can for as many people as she can in as many ways as she can for as long as she can. And I think that'll be the Hillary Clinton that I think will disarm people and will begin to think back positive on what the future can be.
And what about inside your own Democratic Party? As you know, should you take the White House and potentially the Senate as well, there's going to be a lot of pent-up liberal frustration over even the Obama years and a push to move things pretty drastically, pretty quickly. It's going to come up against governing realities. But how realistic do liberals, do progressives need to be about the capacity to get things done in this sort of divided country, in this sort of divided Congress? You need to see a Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. Do they need to scale back their expectations?
I think that Hillary's adopted a number of their programs, for example, a number of Bernie's programs, the college education program, going after Wall Street. I mean, I think those are all things that she took because of the challenge from Bernie Sanders. The more difficult thing is not going to be Democrat, it's going to be Democrat-Republican. And there she has to reach out to what I think are, to 30 or 40 Republicans who in the House who are reasonable people and who are not the far-right, alt-right people. And who, by virtue of education, life experience, and faith, really understand that for democracy to move forward, there's got to be compromise and propose things that are real compromises. I mean, just give you one example. You know, there are $3 trillion offshore. Well, Republicans want to have that brought back without tax. Democrats don't want to have it brought back without a lot of tax. We also have enormous infrastructure needs. So what you can do is you can say, okay, we can bring those back for a year or two without tax, but 25% of it has to be invested in 1% government infrastructure bonds so that we could get $500 billion to build infrastructure without raising taxes. And so I think there are plenty of things that substantively are out there that both sides could agree on. And, you know, each has to deal with the left or the right of their party. But the governing people are always in the middle.
And you, as a senator, of course, you were there for 86 tax reform, which where you had to work with Republicans, and you quite effectively worked with Republicans on issues that seemed very, very difficult at the time. What is your sense about what it will take to get those people that are interested in governing back together again? And was this, you know, so much has been focused on the hard right, on the Ted Cruzes of the world, who, you know, were no compromise. They wanted to fight Obama from the start. But don't you think that there was some fault on the other side in this kind of 6 years of gridlock?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it helps to look backward. I think we got to look forward, and clearly there's a middle, and I think that middle has to be assert itself. And it can be, you know, two-thirds Democrat. It could be three-quarters Democrat and 25% or 30% Republican. But that's how you govern. I remember I went up to testify with Bob Packwood, who's Republican chairman of the Finance Committee, when we did that tax reform bill back in 1986. And by the way, that's the bill that put me on Donald Trump's loser list first.
Because congratulations.
We took away a lot of his tax shelters. But we were before the committee, and we were talking about how we did it. The Finance Committee, bipartisan, wanted to know how we did it. So we started talking. And Packwood told the story, well, we got to a point where things weren't working, so I convened a meeting every morning from 7:30 to 10:30 with four Democrats, three Republicans, and we wrote the whole bill. And when we had disagreements, as we would, we'd have a vote, and it was sometimes 2-2, sometimes 3-1, sometimes 4-0, and whoever won the vote is what was in the bill, and all seven stood by it. And as we began talking about it, I began realizing that it was a lot of fun to legislate something gigantic that affects 100 million or plus Americans in a very intimate way. And then I turned to the committee and said, are you guys having any fun? and they all kind of shook their head. No, because they're not legislating anymore. They're not making a difference because they're just following whatever their leader says that they have to do in order to win the next election.
You know American by the people, way, one who tried was Marco Rubio with the immigration bill. And he was destroyed, I think, in a large part during the primaries. I mean, he made some mistakes along the way, but by constantly having to answer the fact that they had video of him standing with Chuck Schumer, you know, working on immigration, and it was devastating in a Republican primary.
Well, you know, I do not think a success in politics is trying to hide what you have done or diminish what you have done. I think you're much stronger if you come out and say, yes, I did that, and here are the five reasons I did that, and here are the five reasons why that position is better than the position you're taking. That's a much stronger position, and people would respect it. It's not that anybody doubted that he had it. It was how he did it.
Senator, you're a student of history. I'm curious, when you look at this moment that we're in right now, how are we going to look back and describe this year, this period in our history? Do you think it's more likely that this is kind of a one-off, that we look back and say, wow, this is when the country went in some weird directions? Or is it going to be the start or the midpoint of an extended period of a lot of just fierce anger and polarization that led to some really unexpected results?
Well, I gave you some suggestions of what Hillary could do to make it a one-time thing if she wins this election. I think that what has happened in this election is the emergence of the far right. Ever since Goldwater, they were kind of hidden. They were in the backwaters. Well, they're right in front, and I think it's a challenge for the Republican Party, because most Republicans don't agree with what they've proposed, whether it's some of the outlandish, outrageous innuendo and rhetoric they've used, particularly with regard to African Americans or toward our democracy itself. And I think that you can look forward and say this was a time where America came to its senses because it got very close to the abyss and pulled back. And I think that that's where good people who are reflecting the good people in America, and I still think America is a country where when I travel around, for as I have for 50 years as a politician, a basketball player, and a businessman, informs some sense of who the American people are. I mean, people are decent, they're tolerant, they're innovative, they're generous, you know, they're hardworking. And this is the America that Trump ran against and is still running against. And I think that we have to respect that America. And if we respect that America, we then end up with, we're never going to get rid of the 15 or 20% haters out there who are total haters. But we certainly will be able to pull the 30 or 40% reasonable people who, out of frustration, out of the desire for change, whatever that change is, would have voted for Trump. If, on the other hand, Trump wins, God forbid, I think we're in uncharted territory. I think we're going to end up with several early tests of foreign leaders testing Trump. He's never been tested. He's never had any foreign policy experience. And I think that the markets are going to be extremely volatile and risk going on to the downside for the same reason. He's going to say stuff that are going to shock the markets. I mean, just think of the day he said, well, we'll default on our debt. He will renegotiate our debt. Well, that might be what you do in a real estate deal in Queens, but you don't do that with the Chinese. And so there's just so much he doesn't understand that I'm worried, first of all, foremost of all, because he's got his finger on the nuclear button, but all these other reasons related to the economy and to our general role in the world are also concerns.
You know, it sounds to me like you are literally saying there's a question about whether or not America could survive a President Trump.
Oh, I think America will survive. I mean, that's not the issue. There are 100 things that could happen. I mean, you know, you could have a Republican Congress impeach him for something. He doesn't have a lot of friends up there. Hmm. You could have him resign once he's settled his income tax issue, right? And it could find a lot of things happen. So I don't doubt America. I just doubt Donald Trump.
All right. Well, Senator Bradley, thank you for joining us. I remember quite vividly traveling around Iowa and New Hampshire with you during your presidential run back in 2000. I've wondered a couple of times during this one, seeing some of the challenges that Hillary Clinton has had, both in the primaries and now, frankly, if you ever had any thoughts about suiting up again.
No. I'm in the Basketball Hall of Fame.
Well, I can't let you go without letting you off the hook on the Knicks a little bit here. Phil Jackson's Knicks now. How many wins do you see for the Knicks? Give me an over-under. Give me a line here for the Knicks. Are they going to break 500 this year?
They'll be over 40, maybe over 45.
So that's close to 500.
Yeah. They'll be over 500.
How many years?
I think they'll make the playoffs.
Okay, so that was my question.
Of course, my deep friendship for Phil might be maybe impacting what I just said, but no, I think they seem to have a really good team. They got some good young players. They have some experience in Noah and Rose, and if they're healthy, I think you could get to 45 games.
All right, you heard it here. Bold predictions. Bill Bradley thinks Hillary Clinton.
In the playoffs, you never know what will happen.
That's right. I think this year has taught us that, if nothing else. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you,
okay,
Senator Bradley.
Take care.
Well, you know, there you go, man. I think he, you know, when, I mean, he's raising nuclear annihilation as the consequences of a Trump.
That sounds serious to me.
I mean, that's
One thing, this election has brought a whole bunch of Daisy comparisons. There was also a Hillary Clinton ad that mimicked the imagery of Daisy, and it has become infamous even for its use over the top. So people have tried to say, well, we don't want to quite say that, go there, but I think we've seen people go there.
Oh my God.
This election cycle has broken that seal.
Yeah, well, there you have it. Okay, well, that will do it for this day's edition of Powerhouse Politics. We're going to keep going right through the weekend. Please sign up, subscribe if you have not already on iTunes. Give us a review, give us a rating, 4, 5, 6 stars, whatever they let you do. Today's show was produced by Robin Gradison, David Rhine, Michelle Boncardo. We'll be back tomorrow for the next daily podcast, and we'll talk to you then. For Rick Klein, I am Jonathan Carl.